Thanks for downloading this podcast from The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry, and if you're ready, we'll begin. This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening on this Martin Luther King Day. This is the most complicated of American holidays, I think. It's a day of remembrance of so much violent history, a reminder of the difficult path to walk towards justice in America. It's a day of admiration for Dr. King himself, a leader like no other in our history, and a martyr who takes his place along with Abraham Lincoln in the pursuit of the original vision of justice and democracy in America. But as a day to celebrate, what is this day? King Day is a celebration of an incomplete triumph of the civil rights movement, but it is also a cautionary memory day, a reminder of things we might rather forget or that we must never forget, not unlike Israel's Holocaust Remembrance Day. We'd love to know how much of this day for you is a remembrance and how much is celebration. Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE with your story or tweet us at The Takeaway. Also, you may go to thetakeaway.org. We're going to begin this hour, though, looking at the latest initiative from the first African-American president, Barack Obama. He's seeking fiscal justice with a plan to tax couples making $500,000 a year or more. The president is expected to make this program part of his theme of addressing income inequality in the State of the Union address. With me from the Capitol is Takeaway Washington correspondent Todd Zwillick. Todd, welcome.
Hi, John.
So this is terribly new, this proposal. The income level seems to be a slight tweak, but this is something the president has been after for a while.
Parts of the proposal are new, parts are brand new, and they're all going to hopefully, in the president's mind, pay for some of the initiatives that he's been touting as he travels around the country in the run-up to the State of the Union address tomorrow. Well, John, the president wants to raise about $320 billion through changes in taxes. And you mentioned those couples making $500,000 or more. Here's how he wants to do it. The capital gains rate, you've heard of that. This is not income tax. This is the tax that people pay when they sell stock securities, when they make a lot of money, when you hold them for over a year. Well, right now, for top income households, that capital gains rate is 24%. And a lot of analysts will tell you that that, for most people, is underneath the rate for income, which means very wealthy people who sell stocks pay less tax on it than average working people. The president says, raise that. Raise it from 24% up to 28% for couples making over that $500,000 per year. There's a couple other proposals to eliminate something called the step-up basis. That's a fancy way of saying, John, if you have a lot of stocks and securities and you die and give them to your kids don't pay any capital gains on the money that you've made over a lifetime of holding those stocks. It's an advantage. The president says subject that bequeathed stock to capital gains taxes. And another thing, how about charging the big banks 0.07% if they have over $50 billion in assets? Take all that together, you raise about $320 billion, and the Treasury and the White House point out you raised 99% of it from the top 1%.
And is this likely to attract the familiar blowback from the Republican Congress, or is it designed to really address some of their concerns?
Oh, no, the former. This has and will attract some of the familiar blowback. You've already seen responses from Republicans on the Hill who, after all, are the ones who are responsible for writing new tax policy and will, in an attempt to reform the tax code upcoming later on this year. No, they call this raising more taxes and spending it on social programs, the old sort of tax and spend mantra of liberals. Now, there is some agreement, though, buried deep within this proposal. The president wants to take a lot of this money, this $320 billion that we talked about, and transfer it elsewhere in the tax code largely. Triple the value of the child tax credit. Have a $500 second earner credit to encourage second earners in the household to go to work. A lot of people, John, analysts will tell you, have been staying home and not getting that second job because wages are stagnant. We all know that for the last 15 years. If wages are stagnant, it takes away a lot of the incentive to go out and get that second job because you have to pay for childcare and commuting costs and not being with your kids. A lot of people don't bother. That's bad for the economy. Expand the tuition college tax credit. Make more of it refundable. And here's one that does have bipartisan support. Expanding the earned income tax credit for some workers. Paul Ryan agrees with that one. Now, you asked, is there going to be a lot of agreement from Republicans on these specific proposals? The answer is no. But we've talked about tax reform, the big giant reform that Republicans and some Democrats want to do. Each of these items in here could be bargaining chips for the president. They're going to need his signature if they want to reform the tax code, lower corporate taxes, and raise up to $1 trillion in tax reform. If they want to do that, they need the president. And the president can bargain. He may get a couple of these things buried in there. He's never going to get the whole thing. This whole thing is a political message. Tax the very, very rich and help the middle income, middle class people whose wages have been left behind over the last 15 years.
Does this proposal have some sort of strategic value in the sense that it puts Republicans in a position of having to vote for lowering taxes or not raising taxes on this level of income?
Well, it does have a political basis in the end, because I think the president, like you and I, John, know that this proposal writ large is going nowhere in Congress. So it absolutely has a political basis. Now, will Republicans be forced to vote on lowering taxes? That really depends on the type of tax reform that they write. It's going to be difficult in a lot of cases for Democrats to force votes for these types of things that the president wants. They may have one or two opportunities down the road to say, are you for or against, you know, a surcharge on big banks kind of thing, something that liberals would love to see. Are you for or against raising the capital gains rate on the very richest stockholders, something liberals would love to see. They may get a shot or two at it, but it's really going to be up to Paul Ryan and John Boehner and the Republican tax writers on the Hill, Orrin Hatch, to go to the president with their proposal and then let him try to bargain with them for one or two things he needs if they want to get his signature.
Todd Zwillick, Takeaway Washington correspondent. Do you think taxes should be raised on the wealthy? Vote in our poll at thetakeaway.org. Here's someone who's tired of the nasty rhetoric on Capitol Hill regarding taxes and is fine with being taxed. Eric Schoenberg is the wealthy chairman of the board at CampusWorks Incorporated, a technology management company. He's also a member of the Patriotic Millionaires, a group of wealthy Americans who are in favor of raising taxes for the rich. Welcome, Eric.
Hello.
Now, you're a business school professor, you're a chairman of a financial institution, and a member of this group, Patriotic Millionaires. Do you believe that people whose incomes are higher than $500,000 a year should be a kind of an ATM for the federal government?
Well, I'm not quite sure whether I would put it that way, but I certainly do believe that people who are in the fortunate position of earning lots of money are probably paying less taxes than they ought to be.
And what would you do to change that? Would you impose a federal tax, or would you think that these people should be more forthcoming about the taxes they already are employed to pay?
Well, I mean, I think there are a lot of separate issues. I'm certainly in support of the president's new proposal. I think it makes some important points. One thing I will note is the current debate about inequality. There are a lot of questions among the economics community and the public policy community in general about what's causing this drive towards greater inequality. One thing that I think is undeniable, however, is that when you have a tax policy that taxes income from wealth at a lower rate than it taxes income from labor, you're simply going to exacerbate the problem. And that's the situation we're in today. I pay taxes at a substantially lower rate on my income from capital than I do on my income from when I actually work. And I think that gap needs to be closed.
A lot of people in the sort of mid-high income zone earn their salary and then invest it and then pay a capital gain that it feels like an additional tax, a double tax on their income. It's not as though their trust fund is being taxed. It's income that they put away in investments. How would you deal with that?
Well, I think it's an inaccurate characterization of the situation. When you invest money, you get additional earnings on that invested money. I'm not quite sure why people think that this somehow is double taxation. I would further note that one of the key points of the president's proposal is, in fact, to ensure that people of substantial wealth, the money is, in fact, taxed at least once. under current tax policy, when somebody passes away and they have substantial investments that they have not previously sold or liquidated, no capital gains tax has yet been paid on it. Under current law, when you die, the basis, that is to say the level above which further gains are taxed, is reset at the level of what it's worth at the time you die. The president proposes to change that such that when you die, you have to pay capital gains tax on accumulated gains. To me, this is single taxation. This is not double taxation.
What about death taxation? These are terms that are used by the opposition to create a sense of outrage over proposals which you consider to be fairly straightforward fiscal mechanisms.
You know, nobody really likes paying taxes, and I'm not going to claim that I particularly enjoy it either. But the fact is the government needs a substantial amount of money to run. And if you look at, you know, what is better, taxing people when they earn money for working as a fireman, a teacher, a business executive, or taxing large estates when that money gets passed on to an additional generation? It seems to me that it is eminently fair to ask people who are inheriting large amounts of money to contribute some portion of that to the public purse. So this idea of death taxes is, I think, an unfortunate term. You know, my view is this is an important way that we're going to prevent the kind of intergenerational inequality, the kind of wealthy aristocracy that this country was founded to oppose.
What do patriotic millionaires have as their message, aside from what you've already said here? Are you recruiting individuals? Are you lobbying individuals? Do you have any sense that people listen to what millionaires say?
Well, we are a loosely affiliated group of people who are basically trying to take advantage of the fact that, yes, in this country, people have a great deal of interest in what the wealthy have to say. And this group of wealthy individuals is basically saying, in essence, look, we are in all in this together. We all benefit when we have a society that works for everybody, when we have a society that offers equal opportunity to everybody. And the wealthy have a particularly important role to help ensure that that takes place. We are not generally advocating for particular policies, but more generally for this principle that everybody ought to contribute and the wealthy who've done so well out of the economy for the last few decades ought to take the first step in making those contributions.
Was your last national vote for Democrats or for Republicans, Eric?
Well, I do nowadays tend to vote Democratic, although I will note when I originally registered to vote back in the 1980s, I was registered as a Republican. In fact, I think I am currently registered as a Republican as well. So I have no opposition to Republican candidates. I just feel that the Republican Party as a whole has gone so extreme in opposing any attempt to have the wealthy of this country contribute to the greater good that I do tend to vote Democratic.
Eric Schoenberg, thanks so much.
Thank you.
He's the chairman of the board at Campus Works, a technology management company, and a member of Patriotic Millionaires. Is equality in America something economic or another kind of issue on this Martin Luther King Day?
Hi, Cindy from New Jersey. Unfortunately, with human nature, there always has been a pecking order. I don't think, no matter how much we try, that'll ever go away. Someone always feels they have to be on top. Any kind of real equality is a long way off, if ever.
Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE.
Support for The Takeaway comes from Lumosity, introducing a 10-minute fit test to challenge memory, attention, and problem-solving. With brain games to calculate baseline scores and build a personalized brain training program, performance can be compared to global averages. Learn more at lumosity.com.
On this Martin Luther King Day, we focus on something King would never compromise on, the right to vote. It was guaranteed in the Constitution that it should be restricted in any way was something he could never abide. The Voting Rights Act of 1965 made it very difficult to regulate voting on the local level. States and localities had to prove to the federal government that local regulations did not have the effect of disenfranchising large groups of minorities. In 2013, though, the Supreme Court softened that burden of proof and opened the door to new regulations that are expected to have an impact in the 2016 election all over the U.S. Add to this the fact that throughout the country, millions of people who encounter the criminal justice system often end up losing their right to vote and other rights to participate in their communities. Glenn Martin is a criminal justice reform advocate who spent 6 years in prison in New York State. Today, he has the right to vote, but only here in the state of New York. And Myrna Perez is the deputy director of the Brennan Center's Democracy Program. They both agree progress has been made, but there's still work to be done.
Our country has made enormous strides in terms of making the ballot box more accessible. But in recent years, we've seen that right being contested. We've seen some of the greatest pushback against voting rights since Martin Luther King's era. And as a country, as Americans, we need to ask ourselves, how many barriers are we going to put in front of the ballot box? And on this day, I think Martin Luther King would tell us a couple of things. I think he would tell all people of faith that if we really want to have the kingdom on earth that the Bible suggests that we should have and that we should be striving for, we need to not be making distinctions among people based on race, based on criminal conviction, based on sex, and that if we are really going to truly be free, we need to have a fair and equal voice.
Why is it the case, Glenn, that if you commit a felony, you should not forfeit your right to vote, as is seemingly an unquestioned principle in so many states around the United States?
Sure. I believe that, you know, your citizenship is very closely tied to your ability to be able to vote. And unfortunately, in this country, we have decided that involvement with the criminal justice system in many states means that you will not have that right, sometimes forever. And unfortunately, what we're sending is a very strong message to people who've been involved in the criminal justice system, people who are disenfranchised, that they are no longer part of society. And I can't think of a worse message to send to people who already feel alienated and who are trying to fit in than you're not one of us. Talk about creating an environment where people are not disincentivized to stay away from the criminal justice system. And unfortunately, the message we're sending them is quite the opposite. And when I think of Dr. Martin Luther King and all the work that he did along with his allies, I would argue that our criminal justice system is now a surrogate for race-based discrimination, and the many wins that were achieved, what I refer to as the four E's, equality, education, enfranchisement, and employment, have been significantly diminished since those successes by our criminal justice system.
When did you learn that you wouldn't be able to vote based on your conviction?
Sure. Unfortunately, when a person is sentenced in a courtroom, they're not told about what's called the collateral consequences of criminal convictions or the punishments that are imposed by systems outside of the criminal justice system. People who end up in the criminal justice system usually have this desire to, one, give back, and two, to be part of society, because having such a system impose itself upon you gives you a lot of reason to be civically engaged. And so I came out and tried to register to vote, actually when you have the right to vote in New York State, which is the day you get off parole. And unfortunately, the local board of election got it wrong and told me that I needed what's called a certificate of relief from disability, which is a discretionary certificate given out in New York State, and also a letter from my parole officer. And if you know anything about parole, you can barely get a letter from your parole officer when you're on parole, much less when you're done with parole.
So where does this come from, this idea of casting felons with the idea that they wouldn't be able to vote? Is that something that comes from the minds of the framers? Is that something that was added on as a kind of punitive addition?
I think when you step back just a bit, during the Jim Crow era, when we saw constitutionally the reenfranchisement or the enfranchisement of African-American males, we also saw that an attendant barriers being put up legally that were designed to get around those kinds of issues. So, for example, poll taxes, grandfather clauses. We also saw the rise of felony disenfranchisement laws. And today, we as a country have a patchwork. There are some states, for example, Maine and Vermont, where you never lose your right to vote, even while you're in prison. There are some states like Florida, Kentucky, Iowa, where it doesn't matter what you did, how long ago it was, how young you were when you did it. If you have a felony conviction, you do not get your right to vote back unless the government specifically pardons you. And I think a number of Americans would be shocked to hear that there are about 4.5 million Americans living and working in our communities that cannot vote because of a criminal conviction in their past.
Is the net effect of this a Jim Crow re-disenfranchisement of African Americans because of the rate of incarceration of African Americans in the United States?
There's a lot of pathologies associated with a policy like this. I mean, certainly one is that there are scores of African Americans, especially African American men, who cannot participate. One of the things that I think is very attendant to the act of voting is all these pro-social behaviors. When you learn to vote, you learn that you have to wait in line. It's the way we resolve political differences. You don't always get what you want. It requires an assension and an agreement to a certain set of rules. And that is the kind of behavior that we want our returning citizens to be able to engage in.
And also, I think Martin Luther King would remind us that we're all in this together. And when you think about criminal justice system with 2.3 million people in prison and over 5 million under supervision on any given day, the truth is that the majority of those folks are white and many of them poor whites. And so these policies also impact poor white Americans disproportionately. The first thing I noticed was the hypocrisy built into the system. We have a criminal justice system, unfortunately, where rehabilitation is no longer a factor the way it was just 30, 35 years ago. And that was my biggest motivator. I saw so many young men, mostly young men of color, very intelligent, being swallowed up and consumed by this system. And so when I came out, part of what I thought I could do is to help change many of the policies that keep these folks on this sort of cyclical path, essentially doing life on the installment plan.
Glenn Martin, national leader and criminal justice reform advocate, spent 6 years in a New York State prison, also the president and founder of Just Leadership USA. And Myrna Perez is a deputy director of the Brennan Center's Democracy Program. Thanks so much to both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Have you ever showed up at the polls and found out that you actually couldn't vote for one reason or another? We'd love to hear your story. You can call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE. That's our number. Also, what do you think we should do about inequality in the United States? One of you in Eugene, Oregon says, if you look around and are old enough, you know that there are less opportunities for working class Americans. The standard of living has dropped for average American families. The supports for the working poor are almost gone or non-existent. The rich are richer than they ever have been before. Civil rights and voting protections are being rolled back. The disenfranchised are marching in the streets again. We'd love to hear from you at 877-8-MY-TAKE, and there's much more at thetakeaway.org.
Support for The Takeaway comes from LegalZoom. For over 10 years, providing solutions for business owners, families, and individuals to get legal help, including incorporation, LLCs, wills, and living trusts. Legal help is at LegalZoom.com.
This complicated holiday in America is part caution and part celebration, Martin Luther King Jr. Day. Martin Luther King claimed he would not get to the promised land, but that we would. He is not around to celebrate any of the promises that may have come true, so it's up to us to observe all that needs to be done to achieve the King vision. More than 50 years ago, as King was gaining momentum as a national leader, he had few tools for making the changes he dreamed of. He was certainly a legendary orator, whose voice has taken its place in the songs of American liberation.
Well, I would say that the spirit of the idea of nonviolent resistance came to me from Jesus Christ. I grew up in the church and always felt moved by and committed to the principles of Jesus Christ, from the Sermon on the Mount on through his earthly life.
From these interviews a half century ago, you can hear a confident Reverend King who was willing to try anything to confront the powers he faced. He was open to anything he thought might work.
The operational technique came to me from Mohandas K. Gandhi, the great saint of India. I became convinced that the Gandhian philosophy and the Gandhian method of nonviolent resistance could serve as the most potent weapon available to oppressed people in their struggle for freedom and human dignity.
King pretty much created the prototype for the faith-based activism that we can see everywhere in America today, where politics, Christianity, and nonviolence were glued together with a relentless organization, organization, organization.
The first thing I did at the Dexter Avenue Baptist Church, where I pastored in Montgomery, was to set up a social and political action committee in the church. Now, this committee was to do two or three things. First, to see that all members were registered voters. Second, to see that all members of the church joined the NAACP and other civil rights organizations that were in the forefront of the struggle. And third, to develop a citizenship awareness within the members, and whenever elections and things like that came up, to seek to educate the members on the issues involved.
this whole philosophy of nonviolence, of some people feel that it's a soft way. You're being soft when you don't fight back. But I think this is misunderstood. I think it takes much more courage to stand up and say, I disagree with you, and yet I will refuse to strike you, but I will love you for what you do for me. But I disagree with you, and I will protest what you are doing to me. And there are many ways we have, I think, shown it in our various protests, our staying off of the buses, for instance.
These words are from interviews with Dr. King and Coretta Scott King from over 50 years ago. Reporter Eleanor Fisher also questioned Martin Luther King Jr.'s most important mentor as a preacher, his father, King Sr.
Do you approve of the method that he is using?
Oh, yes, he's right.
You think he is right?
Oh, yes, he's been ever so much help to me. Oh, yes, his philosophy is sound.
How has he been of help to you?
He has helped us in that we've come to see that his nonviolent philosophy is correct.
50 years later, in a confrontation between nonviolence and violence in the pursuit of justice, how can we score that contest today?
Hi, my name is Barry Wynn, and I live in Brighton, Michigan. We may be making progress as a nation toward equality, but individually, it feels like it does not matter. Our leadership, and especially our culture, is as resistant as ever to inclusion.
Thanks to those of you who called us at 877-8-MY-TAKE. Also, thanks to the WNYC Archives and reporter Eleanor Fisher, who more than 50 years ago interviewed Dr. King, Coretta Scott King, and King Sr. Those excerpts come from those interviews in 1961. Let's hear from some engaged young people now. Many of the young people in the protests around the country last year in communities faced with police violence, those young people had no living memory of Martin Luther King, but they do have their own dreams.
My dream is for there to be a little more understanding of each other's cultures. If I'm black and I'm in a group of white people, for there not to be for me to think I'm the only black person here. I just want to think that I'm in a group full of people. I want there to be less stigma between the races.
That's Bree Person. She's one of the radio rookies at WNYC Radio. She finds more candor about race in social media discussions, where she carries on passionate debates on politics and pop culture.
I'm on Facebook a lot, and there has been a lot of posts on what's happening between the races, and also with the new movie Annie that came out, there are a lot of comments on how they should have never put a black child as Annie because it started off with a white child. And that kind of upsets me because I don't think the whole context of the movie was about whether the child was white or black. It was about an orphan. And that kind of hurts me in a way.
Temiteo Fegbenli is another radio rookie and 18 years old. She graduated from high school last year and plans to pursue social justice in college. Dr. King was someone she learned about first in grade school.
Yeah, I think he would be happy that people are learning about him in elementary school. I think he would be a little bit disappointed with, I guess, the progress or maybe like the lack of progress we've made. Even with Eric Garner and Mike Brown and other young black men who have been killed, it's sort of like the same sort of things repeating. I think he would just see parallels between what was happening in the 60s and what's happening today.
In the protests in Selma, African-Americans and liberal whites put their lives on the line. There seems to be more of a ritual associated with the protests today.
Yeah.
How do you think that could change if you want it to change? Or do you think there is a way to confront authority in the way that Martin Luther King did, you know, without ending up in a much more violent situation?
I think it's impossible to really stage a peaceful revolution. The organization we have today is mostly due to the prevalence of social media. Like that didn't exist in the 60s. And so, like, I think it was much more sort of self-led in how people decided to act. With social media, people set out like clear rules on how they want people to behave, where they want people to meet up. So it's much more of like a group.
more like a square dance.
Yeah.
Everybody knows the rules, but when the music's over, everybody goes home.
Right.
What changes?
I think we're just more distracted. We can go home and then turn on an episode of Netflix or just write this long Facebook status and never revisit the issue again. I think in the 60s, it was less easy to be distracted.
Do you feel responsible to carry forward the King dream? Is that something that is meaningful to you? What will this generation do in its distracted situation to make change happen?
I do feel a responsibility. I think a lot of young people are interested or at least feel empowered enough to make an act and show up at these protests. And in all of these protests, even with the Occupy Wall Street movement, I saw an issue because all of these things happened. And then I think it's been 2 years since that, since mm-hmm. Occupy Wall Street. And what difference do we see? So I think protesting can do a lot. It can bring attention to things, but it doesn't necessarily bring about change.
Do you have a dream?
I do have a dream. I have many dreams. Equality, I think it's much more of a class warfare thing nowadays, more so than a race thing. I don't know if it's positive. It's just like a shifting of issues.
Temiteo Fagbenli is an 18-year-old reporter with the WNYC Radio Rookies Project. One of the things to celebrate on this day is how so much of American culture has retold the Dr. King story of seeking social justice. Jazz, pop music, hip-hop poetry, and the unforgettable voice of this woman who moved in all of those circles.
I'm the best that ever done it.
Pow, pow.
That's my title and I want it.
Pow, pow.
I ain't lying, I'm the best.
Pow, pow.
Come and put me to the test.
Pow, pow.
I've seen him.
The late Maya Angelou. An album released late last year shortly after she died. It was her last project, a fusing of music, hip-hop, her own voice, and her beloved, powerful words. A project she worked on for more than 7 years. Colin Johnson is Maya Angelou's grandson and founder of Caged Bird Legacy, which aims to continue the life work of Maya Angelou. Colin retains powerful memories of his grandmother's life and work, and especially her love of words.
She, just as a child, she used to embed in me the power of the choice of words and word selection. She was a steward of the language and really held close to that. But then the recorded word, especially her having that the unique voice that she had, she understood the power and what it could really do.
It is time for parents to teach young people early on that in diversity there's beauty and there is strength. I note the obvious differences in the human family. Some of us are serious. Some thrive on comedy. Some declare their lives are lived as true profundity. And others claim they really live the real reality.
That voice is amazing. Anybody else in your family have that?
My dad has a very deep voice. I've always, as a young child, I always hoped that my voice would drop like his. I still have not gotten it, and I think I might have to give up that hope.
Those long vowels that just stay with you, that don't quit, even though she's barely breathing, is just really something else.
Yeah.
I've not seen any two who really were the same. Mirror twins are different, although their features jive. And lovers think quite different thoughts while lying side by side.
I think she was a master of the language, and both holding for pause and pregnant pauses and flowing and sometimes break into song and come back to normal voice. She really, I think, utilized all different elements of communication to really convey her message. So it wasn't just about the words, it was the delivery. And just her ability to communicate a message is unmatched in many areas.
One of the most, surprising interviews that I ever heard with her was when she talked about Tupac Shakur and his influence and his you know, transmission of the oral tradition of African American culture. And it made me think, you know, what was she like as a grandmother? Because grandmothers are noted for, I know the rules, and you will not step out of those rules in my presence. But she also had this sense of what was new and fresh.
Yeah. Well, I don't think that she definitely did not get stuck in, you know, a paradigm and was unable to shift and learn. But growing up in her home, absolutely understood that people are going to be people. And her being really a citizen of the world, traveling as much and having friends from all different walks in life and countries and languages and religions, she had an appreciation for the diversity that is humanity. And so I don't think that she really kind of segmented herself to kind of one way of thinking. One of the things that I always loved that she said is she says, "I am a human. Anything human cannot be foreign to me."
Did you ever spend any time around her dinner table and just sort of gaze at the people who were present?
Oh, yeah. I have been amazed. She was a phenomenon. And so to sit around the table sometimes where you have people of all different types of power, from celebridum to political to business, I tell most folks there's almost nobody I haven't met. Nobody. The list is infinite. Even everything from family friends just to acquaintances. But obviously, you know, even like a Nick Ashford and a Valerie Simpson, you know, just to sit around and listen to their stories, to be able to have private time with the president of Barack Obama, to have private time with Secretary Clinton or, you know, President Clinton. Those conversations, you just can't. Not too many people get that opportunity to have not just the formal pictures, which I have all of those, but also just a casual conversation about anything from news, the weather, or the latest baseball game.
I can imagine it was a pretty high level of conversation there. But as you describe it, I can also imagine Maya Angelou saying, "Tony Morrison, could you get the mayonnaise out of the refrigerator there?"
Oh, and look, everybody pitched in Grandma's house, okay? Everybody pitched in. So if it was picking up a plate and taking it to the kitchen, even though Grandma had, you know, staff and other things like that, she didn't look at it as in a kind of, you know, you're here to serve and you're not a real person. Everybody was treated with dignity and respect, last names only, obviously, for some folks. And she kind of took away the veil of hierarchy and power and kind of brought people down to, you know, let's just connect. Let's just communicate.
In the air, now both feet down. Since you're black, don't stick around. Food is gone, rent is due. Cuss and cry, and then jump too. All the people's out of work. Hold for three, now twist and jerk. Cross the line, they count you out. But that's what Hoppin's all about. Both feet flat, the game is done. They think I lost, I think I won.
Harlem Hopstop.
What is she mixing there in terms of the kind of vernacular she's using, the rhythm she's using, and what she's talking about?
Yeah, I think that one, Harlem, obviously, you know, from the Harlem Renaissance and other things, she grew up during a period of time in Harlem that Harlem had this flair about it. And I think that Harlem's really definitely still always has had that flair, but it's really kind of come back in a whole new way now. But really speaking to some of the history of Harlem and the history of African Americans in that area, that's one of my favorite songs on it. It's a fun song, but if you listen to it, it really has a lot of history in it as well.
This album came out late last year, but it was being made as she passed. You have an impression that she understood that time was running out as this album was being made, as this project was maybe her last?
I don't know that she recognized that, but I think that she did. She put her heart into every project, and she wasn't going to agree to do something and then do it halfway. So I think that this particular project, in its development, it has actually been in development for a very long time, even prior to its launching, for years. But her involvement in it, I think she really wanted to really convey something within it, just like everything else she's done, just doing it 100%.
So in your view, and based on your experience with her, your grandmother went gently into the good
oh,
night.
Oh, yes. Absolutely. 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 Without question. I think she left a very strong family behind. And while we cry and mourn for her, the reality is that she left us with such a gift. And I know that she brought me to this point and let me off at exactly the point I needed to be.
Colin Johnson, thanks so much.
Hey, I appreciate it, John. Thank you so much for having me.
Sure. Colin Johnson is Dr. Maya Angelou's grandson and founder of Caged Bird Legacy, which continues the life work of Maya Angelou. Playing some Harlem Hopscotch with the late Maya Angelou on this Martin Luther King Day. Thanks so much for being with us. This is The Takeaway.
Support for The Takeaway comes from the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia and the Rockefeller Foundation, whose transportation initiative is promoting equitable and sustainable developments in communities across the country.